Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning.
And that was Ann.
And this, yes.
And this is Peter, just in case you couldn't guess.
And where has all the summer gone?
Well, it hasn't gone yet. It just hasn't started yet in Pennsylvania, which we call home. But anyway, let's get down to business. So we have an interesting collection of stuff today.
We're going to start with something
oriental.
Colleen Chen, that takes me back to when I first started cooking, actually, not with her, but with her mother. But she'll tell us all about that.
Sure. And then, I guess we'll take a break between then and the Big Green Cookbook. So let's get going with Colleen Chen.
I got so excited when I received this book, a review copy of a book called Easy Chinese Stir Fries, because the author is Colleen Chen. And I think I was introduced to Asian cooking with her mother's products, Joyce Chen, who was an entrepreneur, a restaurateur, and she made my very first cutting board. Welcome, Colleen.
Thank you very much, Anne.
Now, I jumped ahead of the cart a little bit here, but you must have had a very interesting life growing up with a mother if she was bold to be able to launch this all on her own, wasn't she?
Very, very much so. I mean, when she came to this country, she spoke very, very little English and basically did everything. Well, she and my father together. But it was mostly my mother in terms of the food aspect. And we opened the first Joyce Chen restaurant in 1958.
Now, that's going back a ways.
That really is. And I have a wonderful story about the first week the restaurant was open. I always remember this one because it's so interesting. A gentleman came into the restaurant to have lunch. And he sat there, he got his tea, and then, you know, a few minutes later he got up and he kind of went up to my mother and he said to her, kind of a little bit angry, "What kind of Chinese restaurant is this? You don't even have French bread." And in those days, that's what was served in a lot of Chinese restaurants, French bread, you know, bread and butter, chow mein chop suey,
oh, yeah.
You know, the dishes that people thought were Chinese, but in fact we look back on it now and we realize that they weren't Chinese dishes at all. They were basically American dishes, the idea of Chinese food in an American way.
Right. Now, the stir-fry is a fundamental technique, right, of Chinese cooking. But can you explain what makes it different than other kinds of cooking?
Well, what makes stir-frying, which is essentially one of the most important cooking techniques, is that it cooks food with high heat, small amount of oil, and very quickly. And it really was developed because in China there wasn't enough fuel for cooking. And so instead of choosing a recipe technique that would require long cooking, such as stewing or braising or roasting or baking, things like that, stir-frying actually needs a small amount of fuel. And also the fuel that's used, often it was twigs or grass, things like that, that burned very, very hot but very fast. And so that's exactly what stir frying is.
Now,
someone
invented the cooking utensil. I won't use its name because it's your cooking utensil that's used for this purpose.
Yes. Well, the wok has been around for thousands of years, and what we did is basically, and my mother did this. She redesigned the wok and flattened the bottom and put a Western style skillet handle on it. So it made it much more user-friendly and able to be used on an electric stove.
Oh, I see. So it was an adaptation. An original wok didn't have handles and was round. Was altogether rounder in the bottom?
Exactly. The original wok was round in the bottom, and it had two sort of wire handles on the side. And it was round because they didn't use flat burners. They used braziers that had a fuel in the bottom, and on top it was just a hole. And so the pan just sat in the hole, and therefore you could stir-fry with it, and you didn't have to have a flat bottom. And when the round-bottom woks came to this country, they actually had to design what is known as a wok ring.
Yeah, that's what I had.
Right, something to hold it up. But the problem there is it became very, very inefficient. It didn't fit on the burner well, and it was just absolutely impossible to use on an electric stove.
So this was the start of your mother's business then. She was in the Chinese cookware business.
Well, actually, the very start were the polyethylene cutting boards, which Anne said she has one.
Exactly.
That was actually the start of that the company called Joyce Chen Company.
That's it.
And that's how it started, and not with the pan, actually. The pan was really the second product.
I used that for years, that cutting board.
Oh, it's wonderful. It was the first polyethylene board introduced in the United States.
Whatever gave her the idea to use polyethylene?
Well, she got the idea when she was traveling in Japan. And in Japan, because they serve a lot of raw fish, they wanted surfaces that could be cleaned easily. And the sushi restaurants were using polyethylene boards.
Yeah, well, let's not forget that this interview is with Helen Chen. We're celebrating Joyce Chen, and of,
yes.
And of course we should.
Yeah, no,
but
yeah.
The reason that we're on the phone with Helen today is just simply because she produced this wonderful book called Easy Chinese Stir Fry. So, Helen, tell us about that.
Well, really, I think the nemesis of the book and everything that I do in terms of my Chinese cooking, I learned from my mother. And one of the philosophies that I learned from her and that I continue is to make Chinese cooking authentic but yet very accessible. And so that's where the easy part comes in. These recipes are really quite simple, and yet they give very authentic results very quickly. And I think that, as I'd mentioned to Anne earlier before we went on the air, was that these dishes could be made by someone and served to their Chinese mother-in-law, and there would be no problem at all. They'd love it.
See, that's a great thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to refer to the fact that you said that, but you remembered yourself.
Yeah.
Now, you start out with some advice on the whole process of getting ready to stir fry, and then you've got a section on some of the key ingredients.
Yes, I think those are really important, is how to prepare for stir-frying. A lot of people, are concerned about how do they prep for it, the cutting, what kind of utensils, what kind of knives to use, and then, of course, the whole issue of what are the ingredients, the sauces, what kind of soy sauce. And soy sauce is something that's been there for ages, and everyone knows soy sauce, but there are many, many different kinds. And I tried to explain that the Chinese use two basic kinds of soy sauce, which is a light soy sauce, which is a thin type of soy sauce, very much like Kikkoman soy sauce, which is a Japanese soy. Mm-hmm. And then a darker soy sauce that has molasses in it that we use for stir-frying meats. And it gives a different flavor, a different appearance, and it might be worth it for people to have those two different kinds of soy sauce to get more successful results.
Now, we got a product, curiously, actually, made in Richmond, Virginia, called tamari, and I understand tamari is sort of like a super-duper soy sauce.
Well, actually, tamari is a soy sauce that's made without, so usually wheat is used as a starter, but there are people who are allergic to wheat products or gluten, so therefore they would use tamari. So that is it is a soy sauce, but it is wheat free.
Oh, okay. So we just liked it because we thought it was really good.
We were
really surprised when we found out it was made in Richmond, Virginia.
Yes.
Helen, did you choose to go this route with the Asian cooking, the company, and so forth? You actually took over running your mother's company, did you choose it, or did you just get sucked into it?
Well, I guess it was both. When I was young, it's very typical in Asian families that, the children of the family, the whole family will work together. And I grew up with two brothers, and we all worked in the family business, and that was expected. So I think
The restaurant as well as the products?
The restaurant and then the products, and then my mother had a food business. It just went sort of on and on because my mother had tons of ideas, not enough time, lots of ideas. But then later, I found that I actually really enjoyed this work. And my enjoyment was mostly with the cookware part of the business, not as much the restaurant itself, which I found a very difficult business.
Oh, it is. It's terrible.
You really have to be totally devoted. So I spent my time working and developing the Joyce Chen Company for cookware, which, in fact, we sold in 6 years ago. And after my non-compete was over, after we sold the company, I then decided that I really wasn't ready to hang up my apron, so to speak. So I developed a line of Asian cookware for a New Jersey company called Herald Import, and they are the ones that distribute the line called Helen's Asian Kitchen, of which this book is also part of that line.
Well, now, take us through some of the classic recipes that you have in the book, Helen.
Well, some of them I just absolutely love. I mean, one is called chunking pork. And that one is so easy. And every time I do it, people absolutely love it. It's got a dark sauce. It uses hoisin, uses black beans. And the vegetables are red bell pepper, green bell pepper, and regular green cabbage, and a small amount of meat, which is usually pork. Another one is called slippery shrimp. And
I saw that.
It's a funny name for it, but it's basically almost like a little bit like a sweet and sour shrimp, but it does not have, it's not batter fried. So it's much, much lighter. And that is, it's so delicious. Whenever I think about it, I want to have some. And then there are dishes that use, another one that's really, really simple to do is a Shanghai shrimp with peas. And I just use frozen peas and shrimp. And those are the only two main ingredients that are in this dish. And this dish has no soy sauce, so it has a wonderful, bright, crystal color to it. And it's just exceptionally easy to do. It's very, very quick. There's almost no cutting. Just buy the shrimp, get the frozen peas, put the seasoning in, and then stir fry it for maybe 3-4 minutes, and it's done.
Now, tell me this. I know that there are plenty of, there have always been a lot of Chinese restaurants. Is there some kind of a renaissance going on with the, because first we got the Vietnamese and we got the Thai and so forth, but it seems that we've been steered towards some high-end Chinese restaurants recently, like in London.
Well, I think what's happened is that, Chinese cuisine and Chinese food in America is a staple. I mean, I look at it the way Italian food is,
mm-hmm.
that you can find it in big cities, in small towns, and it will always be there. And it changes a little bit in the sense that, yes, Vietnamese food and Thai food was interesting, but then it goes full circle and continues to go back to China, because I see China really as the mother of all Asian cuisines.
Uh-huh. You're right, yeah.
And so, everything is sort of a satellite of China. And as there are more and more people traveling to China, more people coming from China to the United States, it just feeds into that and brings much more of the cuisine and home-style cooking, which, there are thousands and thousands of different dishes from different provinces in China, some of them we probably have never tasted yet. And then there are also things like fusion cooking, where they take Chinese ingredients or Asian cooking techniques and combine them with European ingredients or techniques.
Now, we would find wok cooking all over China.
Yes. Stir-frying is all over China. In other words, we stir-fry, we steam. One thing that they do not do in China is they do not bake, because they have no ovens.
Oh,
and so there is no baking.
Well, again, I guess it goes back to the fuel availability thing, doesn't it?
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct. As well as the fact that because there isn't enough, although China is very large, only 10% is available for agriculture. And so there isn't enough room for grazing animals, and usually when we think of that, we think of cows, and therefore we don't have dairy products. So we don't use butter or cheese or yogurt or cottage cheese or any of those things, many of which we think that are involved in baking.
Well, I mean, you must have studied this you probably traveled all over China, right?
Well, I have 31 first cousins still living in China.
Ah, 31. How could you have 31 first cousins?
Well, because both my parents came from large families of 9.
Oh, wow.
So that means I had 18 uncles and aunts. Most of them have passed away. But so, those were the days still of large families.
Right, well, that's not so anymore, huh?
No, that has changed.
Well, I could talk to you forever, Helen. I mean, you're just so interesting. I mean, you're focused, but you certainly have a broad understanding of what you're about. And I think that if somebody's about to dive into Asian cooking, this is a book to start with.
I think people will really find it very, very friendly.
It is.
And, there are about 60 recipes in there. What I would suggest is these recipes are useful as much for weekday cooking as weekend cooking.
Now, to get your they could get your book on our website, actually, or on Amazon, but to get your other products, how do they access the cooking utensils and
stuff? Well, what they can do is they can go to the website. It's called Helen's with an S at the Helen's Asian Kitchen.com.
Okay.
and they can go to that website, and then they can put in their zip code. I believe there's a place, or they can call the 800 number and find out what stores in their area have the product. I also have a blog at www.HelenChen.com. You can go and take a look at the blog, and through the blog you can also get to HelensAsianKitchen.com as well.
Well, you're organized here. Helen, you're a very organized person.
Well, I try to be, and I think my recipes reflect that as well, that when people look at the recipes, which are, you know, no more than one page, they see that, you know, I pay a lot of attention to what we call mise en place, which is basically put in place. And that is a culinary term that means preparing.
Yes.
You have everything cut, the ingredients ready, the spices ready, the condiments, and all you have to do is then put it all together in the wok, and then dinner is on the table.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for joining us at On the Menu Radio. Helen, it was a pleasure to talk to you, and keep in touch and let us know if you're up to any new adventures. I'm sure you will be.
I will. Anne and Peter, thank you so much. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
And did we too, yes. Thanks, Helen.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We hope that you continue to communicate with us via email, on the menu at onthemenuradio.com, or on Twitter, I'm OTM Dish, or on our blog, Peter writes a blog.
Yeah, or on Facebook, and there are buttons on the homepage of the website for all of those anyway,
yes.
So just to make it easy, and of course we'd love to hear from you. And what are we going to do now? Now we're going to do...
Well, you know, everything is about this one particular color now. It's called green.
So, here's a big green cookbook store.
Jackie Nugent is a registered dietitian and a cookbook author, and she has this book out that is just right on trend, right on the pulse of what's going on in our world. It's called Big Green Cookbook, Hundreds of Planet-Pleasing Recipes and Tips for Luscious, Low-Carbon Lifestyle. Welcome, Jackie.
Oh, thanks very much, so much for having me, Anne.
I asked you off air how long it took, because this book is just crammed with information. Do you want to repeat for our listeners what you said about that?
Oh, sure. Well, it was really just, it was years and years worth of, I guess, experiences and cooking lessons, and even all the way back from growing up with my mom, who was a caterer. So it was basically bringing all of these lessons, and then a lot of what I had done recently in the green arena, I just compiled it all together in actually a very, very short time, because my publisher only gave me 3.5 months.
That's
to get this
unheard
book
of. Absolutely unheard
together.
Of.
So, yes, I had absolutely no life for 3.5 months, but it was totally worth it.
And it's a very green book.
Yes, it is.
It's white, but it's green all over.
That's right.
Now, tell us a little bit about this. I mean, you have so many resources in it, starting with a green kitchen checklist.
Right. So, well, I wanted to put a lot of useful, practical information in here rather than just doing a cookbook where people could maybe follow more plant-based recipes, which is really key for eating healthier and eating greener. But I just wanted to make it as easy as possible from all different angles of cooking, and just starting even with the kitchen, because there's so much we can do even before we even think about the cooking, that we can change how much energy that we're using and be a little bit more conscious with how much water we're wasting, and not keeping all of our little small appliances plugged in. There's just so many things that we can do related to cooking that just all those little things are going to add up.
You harness the microwave a lot.
I do, and that was actually kind of new for me more recently, because I grew up having a microwave and basically just using it for reheating or just something very, very quick, and I never really thought of it a microwave as an appliance that you could really get good quality cuisine from.
No, I think the general rule seems to be real cooks don't use microwaves.
Yes,
yeah, but there's a, There's an exception. Barbara Kafka wrote a whole book on a microwave, and she still swears by, like, this is the only way to cook asparagus.
Yeah, it really is eye-opening if you give it a chance. So that's what I did, because knowing how much less energy you're using, it's basically a microwave, you use about two-thirds less energy than a conventional oven. So I said, if you're wanting to cook greener, we really need to figure out a way to utilize that microwave to the best advantage. And I was kind of amazed even at myself at some of the things that I was able to cook up. But even as simple as something like your potato, but going to other vegetables, like you said, asparagus, but a beet. I used to roast a beet in the oven for over an hour, and that is just such a waste of that. The energy in the oven, it's just basically a bunch of hot air. You're cooking the oven. That heat is so little, but you can do that beautifully in a microwave. So yes, just experiment a little with the microwave and be a little bit more open-minded, and I think you might surprise yourself.
Now, tell our listeners a little bit more about how the book's organized. You start off with all the tips, and we just talked about that, but then you have sections on various different parts of meals and various snacks. But give our listeners a sort of a look inside the cover about how to navigate the book.
Oh, sure. Well, first off, there's all of the front matter of the book. There's about 40 pages that go through a lot of tips, and that you don't have to read it like a book. You can just come to and flip through, and they're very easy to find these tips if you just need to know, okay, what am I supposed to do about this refrigerator? Am I being energy-wise with this refrigerator? So that starts with, like, your green kitchen checklist. And then I go into what I call it 27 clever tips for low-carbon cooking.
Yeah, I'm just looking at that right now.
Yeah, so even that alone, even if you take your own recipes, even if you didn't even try any of mine, which I hope you do, but even if you didn't, just going through that 27 tips, you can actually just make minor changes in some of the things you already do. So,
for example, give our listeners some examples.
Yeah, for example, like the first tip that I have there is called try Earth Style On for Size. What that means is keeping the skins on, using the edible seeds of your produce, for instance, and trying to utilize every single edible part of your food so we have less waste. And if you compost, you're doing okay, and you don't have to worry quite as much about that waste, but a lot of people don't compost. So my goal was, let's see what we can do with some things that we normally don't. Like, for instance, one thing I did in the book is I didn't peel my ginger, and I actually just grated it right with the skin on, kind of like if you ate potatoes with the skin on. So it's still...
And did that work?
It worked.
I hate peeling ginger.
Exactly. So a lot of the tips, they're actually time-saving, too, for people who don't want to spend extra time. And that was part of my goal, is if I'm trying to encourage people to go to a new way of cooking, if it takes more time, I know people aren't going to want to implement that, or they might not keep it up. So I needed to make it as simple as possible. So a lot of the tips will be time-saving.
What's hyper-cooking?
Hyper-cooking. Yeah, that was one of the most fun ones that I had. And that was, for instance, one version of hyper-cooking would be hyper-baking. So I took a chocolate chip cookie recipe, made it a lot healthier and still tasty, because that was my goal here with the cookbook, is I focused on taste first above everything. But what I did with the cookies, for instance, is I would put them in the oven and then turn it on. So no preheating the oven, and then basically bake those cookies until they became cookie shape but not completely baked, and then turn the oven off and finish the baking. And the cookies came out perfectly. So it was, let me take that back. It didn't come out perfectly the first time, but after a couple tries, it did come out perfectly. So
you were using the fact that the oven was still warm, right, although the flame was turned off.
Exactly. So just trying to utilize every bit of energy, every bit of heat that you possibly can. So I did that on the stovetop, too, with what I call lid cooking. And, like, if you want to boil some pasta to make spaghetti with marinara sauce, basically just bring a pot of water to a boil, put your noodles in, and kind of stir them under the water just to make sure they're fully covered. Bring that water back to a boil, which might take 10-15 seconds. Put that lid on the pots and then turn the heat off completely. And whatever the package says, for instance, if it says 10 minutes, then lid cook for 10 minutes, and you don't need to have the heat on at all that entire time. And you have perfect pasta. And it's just, that's how I always do my pasta now. So it's definitely, it's a time saver and energy saver both at the same time.
Yeah, I like the section, use it, don't lose it, with your recipes.
Oh, use it, don't lose it. Right, mm-hmm. Yeah. I try to include a lot of tips along with the recipes, so it just, it made it a little bit, I guess, more fun for the cooking process. You learned a little bit more about what was going on. But a lot of those use it, don't lose it tips you can apply to other foods, not just the recipes that you might be using in the book. And then the recipes are divided up by season, and I think that is very important. Just, I think sometimes we kind of pick a recipe and then go shopping and hunt for certain ingredients, and whether they're in season or not. And I want to kind of flip that idea around and really think about what's available and then decide what to cook.
Now, a lot of times people will say about a cookbook like this, well, it's all very clever, but it doesn't look like real food. So I attacked it like a traditional carnivore and said, where in this book can I find a recipe that would appeal to a carnivore like me?
And I
found one. Because they're steaks with cranberry sauce of some kind. Now, tell us about that. Tell us a little bit about that recipe.
Oh, sure. Well, what I wanted to make sure that I did was incorporate some animal products in the book, because my goal is, let's not just turn vegetarians greener, let's turn everyone greener. So how do we do that? And that's by incorporating some animal products. So what I did is making sure if there are animal products, like the steak, that it's a smaller portion, but I wanted to make it as flavorful as possible. And what I started with was a grass-fed organic meat, so that way it is going to be greener to start with. And then what I like to do is try to incorporate a fruit or a vegetable with every recipe. So in this case, with the steak, I incorporated the cranberries and just cooked it on the stovetop and just created this kind of luscious sauce, kind of like almost like a cranberry gravy that went with the steak. And you actually utilize the lid there too, with the lid cooking technique to kind of trap some of that heat and create just a luscious tasting entree. Or better yet, you can even think of it as more of a side dish and then have a vegetable along with that that's actually your entree.
And you picked up on reason that the Chinese use the technique of chopping finely and then quickly stir frying is because they have a shortage of heat. And, of course, we haven't really picked up on that in the Western world, but you did in your book. You said try to reduce the size of the units that you're cooking.
Right. So
that's an old technique. It's not a new technique. It's a very old technique.
Exactly. And that's what I discovered. It was almost like going back to go forward, going back to go greener, and doing things maybe the way things used to have been done before we had all of this electricity, and using more of your knife cutting skills rather than relying on things like food processors, and then using mallets and pounding your meat thin, like your chicken pounded into a real thin cutlet or paillard, and it cooks very quickly that way. And I think it's much more enjoyable to cook, I think, when you have luscious tasting food and you know you didn't have to spend hours doing it.
Now let's put this to the acid test.
Okay.
You wrote this book in 3.5 months.
Uh-huh.
Are you still cooking green in your kitchen?
Yes. And it's something that I think what happens is after you start doing something a new way and you know that there's a solid reason behind why you're doing it, and it is because I truly 100% believe that this is the best approach to eating greener, living greener, just doing your part to make a difference. I can't go backwards now. So it's really kind of strange. I'm like, I feel sorry for my oven. It's like it doesn't need cleaned anymore. It doesn't really get used. So other than to make cookies every once in a while, but I also wanted to make sure that I tell everyone about is I also talk about the sustainable sweet spot. So I think we also have to be realistic with what we're doing. So Like, I wouldn't want someone to think they can't have roasted turkey on Thanksgiving and spend hours in the oven that day. So it's just trying to find what works best with your lifestyle. If it doesn't fit easily into your lifestyle, you're not going to keep doing it. So I just want to basically have people go as green as they can and just start slowly. So even just picking three things that they want to change into to go a little bit greener. And then once they accomplish that, then go on to the next steps. Almost like a weight loss diet, where you, if you made so many changes at once, sometimes you kind of fall off the wagon.
Well,
yeah.
Jackie, I mean, I think we can recommend to our listeners that those of you who really want to go green and don't know quite where to start, this is a great resource. It's a handbook pushing you in the right direction, or nudging you, not pushing you in the right direction. And I think it's just so full of information. I'm just amazed at all these things.
Have you sent a copy to Obama and Michelle yet?
No, but they're on my list. And I actually thought I might even send one to the chef. I might have a better chance getting one into the hands of the chef than maybe into the hands of Michelle or Barack.
But you know, you can call the I had to call somebody, and that was the number they gave me, and they answered the phone, White House Kitchen, and I almost passed out.
But I don't think that number's available for general circulation. We still have it. It probably still works. They probably haven't changed it, but we don't give it out on the air.
Yeah, it's probably not a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a wonderful book. I would highly recommend it. It's not just a book with ideas. It's a book that's on a mission. And listeners,
good recipes.
I think it's a mission that you should all think about joining, and we of course are doing that too since we read it.
Thank you,
Jackie.
Oh, sure. It's
yeah,
been a pleasure.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
And it's time to take a pause
for the cause.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and we're going to turn our attention to two wonderful women who have just turned their lives around with doing something altogether new, starting their own companies.
Starting their own companies based on something that they just did for fun to begin with, and then people said, you know, you ought to be doing this seriously, and they sure are both doing it seriously.
And successfully,
and they're both wonderful products, and one of them is sweet, and one of them is sort of semi-sweet and savory. So let's hear it for Somebody's Mother's Sauces
and
the gracious gourmet.
On the Menu is so thrilled to meet so many interesting people in the specialty food world, as well, of course, as in the restaurant world and hotel world and travel field. But we're focusing a lot because of the Summer Fancy Food Festival. We're focusing on unusual products, award-winning products. And we have Lynn Lasher on the phone, not only with excellent product, but also with a very interesting story. Lynn, welcome to On the Menu.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann.
Your company is called Somebody's Mother's Sauces. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And when you tell us the story of your company, people will probably get the idea. Why don't you just go ahead and explain how you got started, because you came from a very different world, did you not?
I did. I spent 20 years in financial services, and after I ended that part of my professional life, I started to make up for lost time by jogging and playing golf and waking up in the morning and putting on running clothes instead of pantyhose. And my oldest daughter approached me one day as I was making the loop at our local park, saying, "Mom, do you realize you're just running in circles? Why don't you do something?" And so I decided to follow through on my lemonade stand teachings to the children when they were little. We tried to talk about break-evens and all sorts of other things besides just lemonade, and I resurrected a family recipe of chocolate sauce, and I thought, well, this will be great. It'll be an extension of the lemonade stand, and I'll teach my three children how to start a business, never giving another thought in the world to the fact that we might end up with one, which we have.
And how long ago was this?
That was in March of 2005.
Okay, and it was your mother's actual chocolate sauce.
Yes.
Which is why it's called.
She made the sauce for us growing up. Everyone adored it, and from a very young age, I thought, gosh, someone should make this. This is just wonderful.
It's a fascinating.
So we began with that product.
It's a fascinating name. Somebody's mother, and turns out you were the mother and the somebody at the same time.
Exactly, as we all are.
Well, I'm not. I may be a number of things, but a mother's not one of them.
I love the name because, on the one hand, there's a certain anonymity involved with mothering. Each of the jars has a quote about mothering on the lid, and one of my favorites is that a mother is a person who, upon seeing there are four pieces of pie for five people, promptly announces she never did much care for pie. And I'm tickled by it because we, all of us mothers, make these heroic to semi-heroic sacrifices every day quietly that no one ever knows about or reads about, all due to our commitment to be good mothers. And also, we're all, sometimes when you hear that something's great, it's because it was homemade or someone's mother made it. So I just got that in my brain and off we went with it, and people love the name.
How do you jump from just this idea to actually launching a company with your children?
I'm glad you asked that because it's an interesting story. A friend of mine came over one day on a Saturday and wanted me to go to lunch, and I'm notorious for never going to lunch, and I was a little annoyed, and we couldn't decide on a place, and finally, exasperated, I said, why don't we just run up to the grocery store and get a sandwich and get this over with? And at that point, I walked into the store with this idea still in the back of my brain, where it had been for some time, and I ran into just a wonderful man here, and he's named Roy Garcia. He was selling salsa that was homemade based on a recipe his father had. None of the ingredients were cooked, and so it was very fresh. And it smelled so good as I came around the corner and I looked up and saw him, and he had such a kind face and lovely eyes. And I walked up to him and I tasted his product and I said, this is wonderful. How did you get it from your brain to the grocery store shelf? That was a Saturday, so I was meant to be forcibly dragged to lunch at the grocery store of all places. And to that end, based on what he told me, I made my first call on Monday to get started.
Isn't that funny? We met one person, I think it was last year or the year before, at the Fancy Food Show. I remember her name was Margaret Carter, and she made
She made these
batches of pâtés, and she would take them to the local shop, planning to go in and try to sell them to the owner, and she never went in. I think she went like three times, and finally
couldn't get the
one of our friends got so exasperated, a friend went along and essentially forced her into the store.
Amazing. And we did something analogous to that, which in terms of the humor involved, and that is that in the beginning, when we had our first batch underway, I would go to the park and hit golf balls and rush home and tell the children, guess what, someone bought three jars at the driving range today. And then I'd go to get my hair done or something and say, oh, so-and-so's grandmother ordered a jar and wants us to call her around Christmas.
I was so excited. What was the real story? You were not doing that at all? You were just hitting golf balls?
No, that was the real story. I'd go and hit golf balls and be very excited that we'd sold two jars.
Okay.
And then I went back to the same grocery store with a proper case, and the buyer, Scott Silverman, who's actually involved with the NASFT, I think he's on the board of advisors there, did me the great favor of taking one look at the packaging only before he even tasted it and said, I'll take 20 cases.
Wow.
And we nearly fell over because we'd been selling a jar or two at a time at the beauty shop or the driving range.
And you were still making it at home, probably, right?
Yes.
Well, you now have three products. You have the caramel chocolate and the white chocolate. They're all dessert. So what are these for?
Well, let me back up to say that the white chocolate actually has some pear brandy in it. And the reason it does is that I found white chocolate to be very sweet, and I have a son named William, and I thought, well, I'll cut this with some brandy. Gee, I think I'll give William 15 minutes of fame, and I'll cut it with pear William or pear brandy.
Uh-huh.
We put all of them on ice cream. Last holiday season, we puddled them on plates, and we put a piece of pecan pie, which is a southern favorite here, on top of the chocolate sauce, pumpkin pie on top of the white, and apple pie on top of the caramel.
Wow. That sounds smashing.
Apple slices.
But you can also just spoon it out of the jar, right?
So many people tell us in hushed stones that I exactly what they out do. Of the jar.
Miss Anne's been doing that already, I can tell you.
Yes, and that's my favorite way, to tell you the truth. And actually, after it's been refrigerated is when it's really great, because it has a much thicker sort of consistency, and the chocolate is like having a spoonful of fudge.
Now, let's talk about where people get their hands on somebody's mother. that's a nice way of putting it, huh?
You can actually get your hands, and if you want to, around my neck. I've published my cell phone number on our website and on our everywhere else that we can, so anyone can call me directly anytime. We sell the sauce, obviously, on our website, which is somebodysmothers.com, and there are no apostrophes in that. And then we are in all of the Rice Epicurean markets in Houston, where we live, all the central markets in Texas, and all the Whole Foods in Texas and Louisiana. However, I must add that we went to the Fancy Food Show in the beginning of our fourth year with the idea that we would expand our distribution. And so we're pursuing that right now, and hopefully we'll be in stores closer to you.
Well, now tell me this. The children are still involved with it, and how old are they?
Yes, in varying degrees. They go about their own business of life. I think that I wanted this to be there for them if they ever wanted to come home to it, and or to be a safety net if in the pursuit of their own passions beyond this, they needed to have a safety net or place to come home to. My oldest daughter, funny enough, studied theater at the University of Southern California and has ended up as an actress and as a manager of a singer-songwriter named Amy Cooney. And I mention her name because she wrote a song for us, which you can find on our website, called The Chocolate Song, and it's
oh,
very
cute.
Popular. As she tours the country, people request that song as an encore. But she has put to work some of the skills that she learned, I think, through this process. She negotiates contracts and so forth for us, so she has picked up quite a lot of business savvy. My second daughter graduated from the University of Southern California as well and changed her minor to business. And my third child, my son, is at the University of Texas studying business. And they have, and I'm very gratified that each of them has told me individually that they learned so much through this process, primarily because they have a context or frame of reference for business now, which they might not have otherwise had.
And that's brilliant, Lynn. That's absolutely
so
brilliant.
Thrilled.
Nancy Wexelbaum, you're a very gracious lady, and we are really mad for your product. Your company is called The Gracious Gourmet. We came across it through this dill carrot tomato tapenade I ate it right out of the jar. Tell us a little bit about how you ended up, since this is not how you started out, how did you end up in the food business?
Well, I started making some chutneys for a friend, and in February of 06, I had a 98-year-old lady over in the little town I live in Connecticut, Bridgewater, Connecticut.
Oh, you're in Bridgewater. That's great.
Do you know Bridgewater?
Yes, certainly do.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yeah.
Because it's a very tiny town. Most people have never heard of it, so I'm impressed that you know it, Ann. Anyways, this lady came over. She was 98 years old, and she's sort of a legend in the town. There was a power outage, and I said, come on over and have dinner. And so she did, and I served some of the dried fruit chutney, one of my first products. But this wasn't a business. I was just making this for friends. And she said to me, this is so delicious, you should start a business. And I said, what a great idea. So the next day, I used my background. My background is economic strategic planning, and I worked with my husband in retailing for 22 years.
So you're natural for this kind of thing, huh?
Well, I wanted to do something different, and I love whenever my husband and I on a vacation, or we were with the children on a vacation, we always planned where we would go by how good the restaurants were.
Yeah, yeah. And now they have a name for it called culinary tourism. Yeah,
well,
but they never had that before, but that's how we travel too.
Well, I agree with you, and instead of clothes shopping, our favorite shopping expeditions, we're going to different kinds of markets.
Oh, I love that too.
And it's wonderful too. We were in Morocco once, town, city of Fez, and I said to the guide, after he showed us the tourist sites, I said, now I want to go to a wonderful supermarket in a great residential area where the local people go.
Oh.
He took us, and I have to say it's so fascinating because it taught me the regional, I learned a lot about the culture of a country by visiting their food markets, and I learned about the kind of food they like. You could see the kind of products, the kind of meats or chicken or fish they have in their meat areas or in their produce areas or in their cheese areas. So I've always had a love of food. Anyway, this lady said to me, you should start this business. I was, after having worked in New York City for about 35 years, I wanted a break. And so we have a little house in the country, and I said, okay, I'm going to start a little food business. And I said, should I have 6 chutneys or should I go in different condiment categories? And I went in different, decided to do a couple chutneys, a couple spreads, and a couple grilling sauces. And so I started, and I developed 6 different products, and I found someone who could make them, and that's what got me started. And then I was nervous that no one would like the products.
Oh, the products are wonderful.
Thank you. But at the time, I said, oh, my gosh, the co-packer said we have to produce 500 pounds of each of these products. For an initial run, it will give you about 50 or 60 cases of each. And I was terrified that no one would like them. So
yeah, you thought you might be eating chutney for quite a long time, you and all your friends.
Yeah, I said, I like them, my friends like them, and I gave them to a whole different variety of friends and family. And I said, Casey, what do you think? And everyone liked them. I still didn't know if gourmet shops, food markets, cheese shops, butcher shops, cooking schools, etc., would be interested in buying them, because I don't sell to the supermarket chains like the A&P. I feel this is a special product and it needs to be in a store with light types of products. So what I did was I made up batches of these products in my own kitchen before the initial run, and I put them in little ball jars and just put them in my car and did searches of all the gourmet markets in Connecticut, and I started calling on all of them and let them taste what I'd made in the kitchen and showed them what the label was going to look like and what the product was going to look like, taste like, and I said, would you like to order them? I'll have them in a couple of weeks, and a lot of people did, and that's what got me started.
Now, are these family heirloom recipes, or did you make them up yourself, Nancy?
Well, made them up from my head.
Do you know, you're not explaining quite how did you get so much talent and just flavor. I mean, it's just, these are so original and so creative. I mean, who would ever think of putting dilled carrots and tomatoes in a tapenade?
Well, first of all, Anne, thank you very much for that compliment. That's very, very nice of you to say. Actually, dill and orange and carrots are a very classic combination. I added the tomato because I was actually in a restaurant with my husband, and I had a tomato sauce with some fish that had dill in it. And I thought, this is really delicious. And then I thought of carrots and the dill and then adding the orange, and that's how it came about.
And then we also had an exotic fruits.
It was a tropical fruit spread.
Tropical fruit spread,
yes.
Is that a dessert topping, or, I mean, I think, again...
Well, that is absolutely fabulous with pork. It's great with a piece of fish, because the passion, it has a base of passion fruit concentrate.
Oh, that passion
coconut
fruit.
Coconut in it. And that, it's a rather acidic, passion fruit is a rather acidic fruit, and it really balances something like chicken, or balances pork, or, the richness of those meats, or fish.
Oh, I mean, it's so fresh, too, because, I was so spoiled when we lived in Australia with the passion fruit. I mean, you probably paid 10 cents a piece for them. Here, they're $3 or something. But this tasted very fresh. In fact, that's another characteristic of your product, the freshness.
Now, let me ask a slightly different question. You talk about those two recipes, and they were successful. Now, have you ever tried a combination and you knew it would be perfect and it just didn't work?
That's a very good question. I'll give you an example. If I can use the dill carrot tomato again, what I really wanted was to do a tomato pesto that would be very fine and taste just like a tomato out of the garden that just picked it right now at the end of July and just sliced it, put some salt on it, and ate it. See, I think it's such a wonderful flavor. And I kept playing around with that and that concept, and I could not achieve that. I tried it with tomatoes that were sun-dried, with some fresh tomatoes, with some roasted tomatoes, all different types of tomatoes, and try what I might, it did not work. And eventually, I ended up with the dill carrot tomato.
Isn't that funny?
I don't know if you can get that fresh tomato. I mean, there's nothing to compare to it, especially when you pick it from your garden and it's still warm from the sun.
I don't know, Ann, and if you find out,
I'll let you know.
I'll develop that tomato pesto, but I think for myself, at least, I've learned a lot about what is available on the industrial food market, and it is amazing the variety of products that are available for somebody who is developing new condiments.
Uh-huh.
So many things available in so many different forms. And I think that just by understanding a little bit what's available and then testing, just playing with things and letting my imagination, for in my case, sort of just go a little, makes it very exciting for me.
Well, do you sort of do this in your kitchen to see if it's going to taste good before you turn it over to the manufacturer?
Oh, yes. I sit with everything that, when a manufacturer takes someone's product to produce, everything has to be in gram weight. And so I sit with my scale. If I can put a little aside, I love cooking this way because measuring is so accurate. Instead of taking a half a cup of this, a teaspoon.
Oh, yeah. You're correct.
Whatever, a teaspoon of sugar for you could be different than a teaspoon for me.
Right.
And so I sit in my own kitchen with the scale, with a pad of paper and a pencil, with ingredients I want, and then I just, looking at the quantities myself, measure out what I want to put in and cook it and jar it in those little ball jars. And then I taste it and let different people taste it. And then I say, this has a little too much of this or a little of that. Let's see what it would look like a little different. And then I'll make it again. The gingered peach apricot, for instance, gingered peach apricot spread, I made that 16 times before I came up with what I thought was really something acceptable.
Now, how are people going to lay their hands on these products? You said you deliberately don't put them into supermarket distribution. Can people go to your website and find out where they can go?
People can go to my website, list the retailers who sell the product.
Oh, great, okay.
And so anybody who wants to buy the product can go to the website. I have a couple of internet providers. Well, and if somebody really has a problem, they can always give me a call, and I'll make sure I find someone who can get the product for them.
And that website, again, is, Nancy?
www.thegraciousgourmet.com.
And you're a very gracious lady, Nancy, and it's amazing. This second career you've had is just a little bit different, but I sense that you're having a lot more fun with it.
You know something? I have to tell you both, I am having the most fun I've ever had in my life.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
I gained a lot of weight, but you know something?
Well, we all do that. We all do that.
It's tremendous fun, and I thank you very much for contacting me and including me on your show.
And when you get some new products that you'd like us to test, we would love to.
Yeah, we're available as testers.
We have spoons at the ready anytime you send us something, we'll start spooning it right away. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you both very much, and I appreciate your interest.
Thanks, Nancy. Bye.
And thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that just about wraps up another program for us. And I wanted to make a comment. I wonder if anybody read this I sent for a copy, a review copy of Frank Brody, the critic for the New York Times, his autobiography. I haven't got it yet, but I did read the excerpt in the Times. Did you read that, Rabideau?
No, I didn't. No, no.
It was really disgusting.
Oh, dear.
About his bulimia and his...
Oh, dear.
I mean, what a terrible thing to have to...
Why was it necessary to write about it?
That's what I don't understand. Why do we need to know all this about him?
That's sort of like Gordon Ramsay's life story.
Exactly.
It's just one of those
or
books.
Or Marco Pierre White, which is even worse.
Your best friend should have told you that this was
not a good idea.
This is a book that wasn't necessary. You couldn't possibly have needed the money that badly.
Well, after I get the book and read it, I'll report again.
We'll give you a report on the whole story, and if it's really good or if it's really bad, in either case, I guess we'll invite Frank on the program to talk about it and see if he has the gall to step up. And in the meantime, we hope you'll have a wonderful week, and we'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.